Rivas Aviron. I'm Vernon Kurtz, past president of Radical Assembly, and I want to take just a moment of personal privilege to, first of all, welcome Jerry into a very important group of past presidents. On behalf of myself, Gila, and Alvin, who are here, we look forward to your activity with us now. And we also, our new colleague, who is the president now, Billy, who's not here, I don't believe, we do want to welcome him and offer our help and assistance in any way possible. I rise today as to chair this event for a special privilege. It is not surprising that the place is already filled because we know we're in for a very special treat. Ambassador Dennis Ross, who will be introduced in a few moments, always brings a cogent, articulate, and a very committed and passionate view of the Middle East, to which he cares about so deeply, and of course we do as well. But I also want to spend a couple moments on one of the best-kept secrets, I think, of the Jewish world. And that is what is known as JPPI, the Jewish People Policy Institute. I'm privileged to serve as a board member of JPPI, which is an independent professional policy planning think tank, which was established by the Jewish Agency in Israel. It's based in Jerusalem. Its office is actually on Givat Ram, near the dorms where many of us lived for a long period of time. And its co-chairs are Ambassador Dennis Ross and Ambassador Stuart Eisenstadt, both of whom are close friends of this movement, involved with us, and deeply devoted to the Middle East and to American policy and to this country. JPPI is something that I think if you don't know about, you should learn about. I would suggest you go on its website, www.jppi.org.il, and you will learn of its policy work. Each summer, just before the holidays, we put out an annual assessment, which is brilliantly done by many people dealing with geopolitics and social strata. The Pew Report this past time, many things going on around the world, Israel's relations with China and India, with Europe as well. And it's something that I think pre-high holidays everybody should have an opportunity to look at. It has done some excellent work in terms of the American Jewish community and as well as the world Jewish community in addition to Israeli society. And I'm privileged to sit there as a board member on behalf of the Jewish Agency and led by Dennis and Stuart. We meet at least a couple of times a year as a board. And only a couple of months ago, there was a very important two-day conference called Julie and I attended in Glen Cove, Long Island. The JPPI had been asked, first of all, by the FCP Livni, who was the Justice Minister, asked Ruth Gavison, the past Supreme Court Justice, to examine what it means to have a Jewish democratic state. And she turned to JPPI. There have been a number of discussions, not only in the United States and Israel, but around the world. I know in Chicago at a Federation meeting, we had a special meeting. Some of you may have meetings as well. And there was a two-day conference in Glen Cove where we were present as well with scholars from all over, literally the world, came in from Israel as well as from the United States. Julie sat on a panel dealing with religious pluralism, a very important panel, which dictated our understanding of religious pluralism to not only JPPI, but to Israeli thinkers and academics and policymakers as well. And so I would encourage you to be able to learn about JPPI, to examine its work, to get a hold of their stuff, and I think you will be enriched during that time. I can see people going online already. I know how it works, so hopefully I gave the right the right address. Did you okay, Stuart? California, so I feel better, right? But I do think I wanted to bring it to your attention, and I approached when we were in Israel in February through the Jewish Agency meetings. I approached Julie and said I really thought the JPPI should be have a presentation here, and she and Ashira followed through, and we couldn't ask for better than Dennis Ross, who is, as you will hear in a moment, really a special person. Two other things that I just want to do. One is I want to officially welcome Dubi Chayun, our colleague, our co-chair of the Israel Committee and the Israel region. So Baruch Haba officially to this particular case. And it's also an opportunity for me to give Hakarat HaTov to our good colleague Stuart Weinblatt, who literally came in last night and is going back this afternoon. He serves obviously in the Washington area, but as well serves in a number of important things. like Stuart now. He's now a past chairman of the JFNA Rabbinic Cabinet. In my day, it was the UJA Rabbinic Cabinet. Many of us traveled there when I was chairman as well. And he's now he's also the director of Israel Advocacy for the RA and has done some excellent work on behalf of all of us. Not always public, but behind the scenes. We want to thank you officially on behalf of us. And so it's my great privilege to introduce, first of all, Stuart, to introduce the ambassador.
Thanks, Vernon. Dennis Ross is no stranger to us. He's to Mideast peace negotiations what Hershey's is to chocolate, what Heinz is to ketchup. I was going to keep going with this. And then the image popped into my head what Colonel Sanders is to chicken. I said, no, I shouldn't say that. But Dennis has devoted his professional career to public diplomacy and to working on the Middle East situation, to working on helping define solutions while serving both in the government as well as in his private life. For over 12 years, Ambassador Ross played a leading role in these peace process negotiations, during which time he dealt personally with all of the various parties in the negotiations on all the different sides, came to know and develop deep personal relationships with them, and he's always drawn upon that, as he will today in his analysis, but also in terms of his work. He worked closely with Secretaries of State James Baker, Warren Christopher, Madeleine Albright, as well as Hillary Clinton. And having been associated with the Middle East during the administrations of President Reagan, George H.W. Bush, and Clinton, and having served as an advisor on the region in the National Security Council position to President Obama, it's easy to forget that his area of expertise and his first work, as exemplified through his doctoral dissertation, was on the Soviet Union, Soviet decision-making, and his initial work was involved in U.S. policy toward the former Soviet Union. Dennis is currently the William Davidson Distinguished Fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, where he continues to write prolifically and to advise and to speak about the aspects of American involvement and also the current Middle East situation. Now, all of us know, or many of us know, of Dennis's involvement as articulated by Vernon in the Jewish community. He's an active member of a conservative synagogue in the Bethesda, greater Washington area. And in addition to that, let me just mention that he has written several books: Myths and Illusions and Peace, Finding a New Direction for America in the Middle East. He also co-wrote a book called The Missing Piece, Statecraft and How to Restore American Standing in the World. He co-wrote that with Shel Silverstein. And that's a joke. It's just kidding. He's working currently on a comprehensive analysis of U.S. Mideast policy from Truman to Obama. He told me that he is just finishing up the final chapter, which is about Obama. So if we're really good, we might get a footnote in that book, because he's finishing it now. So I would like to introduce Dennis Ross, our speaker this morning, and to tell him how honored we are that he is here. Thank you for all you do on behalf of our nation, our people, and the true Rodef Shalom. Dennis Ross.
But what you don't know is that when Stuart asked me to come, he said, really, there's very little to talk about in the Middle East, so I would really prefer you to give your analysis of the NBA playoffs. And I can honestly say, for anybody who paid any attention to what happened last night, these playoffs are actually inexplicable. It's easier for me to deal with the Middle East than it is for me to explain what's going on right now. That the Washington Wizards could go into Indiana last night and beat Indiana by 30 points. Beating down 3-1 is inexplicable. And for those of you who probably didn't stay up to see it, but because I just flew back from London, I'm jet lagged. The Clippers Thunder game, Clippers were ahead by 7 points with 49 seconds to play, and the Thunder won. So if you can explain these things, you're better than I am.
This is San Antonio territory.
I realize that. I actually was here 2 weeks ago, and it was a game that Dallas won on literally a last second 3-point shot. And yet San Antonio came back to win. So we'll see what happens. And if you have any questions, I'm still prepared to deal with the NBA. I'm full service. I want you to know that. All right, so
you have cards, so that we're going to ask if you do have questions. Investor Ross will take questions, but please just pass up the cards, and they'll be presented to him.
And be sure to spell the names of the foreign players in the NBA correctly. All right, so, you know, I mean, this actually is an amazing period of time to try to talk about the Middle East. It is interesting that I could talk about almost anything other than the peace process and still be highly relevant when it comes to this region right now. We have an election in Egypt in, what is today, the 14th, in 2 weeks. Sisi will win, there's no question about that. And it's probably going to be the high point of his popularity. And the question is, what's he going to do after that? The struggle for Egypt is exactly that. It's a struggle for what the future identity of Egypt is going to be. What the Islamists have been driven underground right now. Is that the end of the Islamists? Well, it depends on how Sisi operates. They will come back if it turns out that he focuses more on control and less on governance. I could talk about what is truly a humanitarian catastrophe in Syria. It actually is incomprehensible. I mean, the slogan, never again, has been reduced to a slogan. I mean, there are 9.3 million people who have been displaced in Syria out of a population of 21 million. We say 150,000 dead, and we don't even know. That number may actually be small. Barrel bombs, starvation, are actually tactics that are treated as being legitimate tactics in this war. You target hospitals, it's a legitimate tactic in this war, and yet the world stands by. I could talk about the Iranian nuclear program right now. Will there be a deal by July 20th? If there is a deal, will it actually leave Iran as a nuclear threshold state or not? And if there is a deal, what are the implications for the region? Does every Iranian neighbors say, okay, we want the same deal? And people forget that the UAE signed what's known as a 1-2-3 agreement with the United States so that it could have, so that we would provide it with nuclear power. They renounced, as part of the deal, the right to enrich. Will they stay with that now? Because there will be a deal with the Iranians. Any deal with the Iranians will be a deal in which Iran will be enriching. Now, it can be constrained. I believe a deal is possible with Iran where Iran is able to enrich in a very restricted way, and that actually could be a good outcome. But every one of its neighbors is going to say, whatever they get, we get too. So I could talk about all those things, but I prefer to talk about the NBA. So... But Stuart actually did want me to talk, aside from the NBA, he wanted me to talk about what's happened on the peace issue. And I'm going to do that. And I'm going to tell you where we are and, in a sense, what I think we should do about where we are. But for you to understand where we are, you have to understand where we've come from. And I don't mean, I'm not going to recite the 800 pages from The Missing Piece, though of course I could. I'm not going to do that. I want to talk instead about what drove Secretary Kerry. Why did he make the effort? It began last summer. What were the terms under which it began? Why did it break down? Why did Jonathan Pollard come up? Who raised Jonathan Pollard? And in effect, is it possible at this point to resume the effort? While there's a lot of noise right now about what's going on, you'll note that Kerry isn't saying anything. And Kerry is making, in a sense, the president's talking about a pause. Other than using the term reassessment, which reminds us of 1975 with Henry Kissinger and reassessment, and Kerry is remaining very quiet right now because he's making judgments about how to proceed, and I want to lay out for you what I think the real choice is. And I'm going to do all that in the next 30 minutes, okay? So, highlighting a skill. I'm not sure what it is, but a skill. All right, so, why did Kerry make the effort? All right, so, Kerry made the effort because he looked at the region and legitimately said, do we need another problem? I mean, think about it. The one area in this region that has not been characterized by upheaval has been the Israelis and Palestinians. It's not to say that it's great. It's not to say that, you know, they have a relationship that is warm and fuzzy. It's not to say any of that, but it is to say that at least until now it's been stable. And it's very hard to find any other place in the region where you can say that. So if you're John Kerry and you're looking at this and you're saying, you know, the one thing I know for sure, we don't need to have this problem as well. It's not in Israel's interest, it's certainly not in the Palestinian interest, and it's certainly not in Jordan's interest. Jordan has absorbed 800,000 Syrian refugees. What do you think that's doing to Jordan? You think that Jordan also now needs to have upheaval between the Israelis and the Palestinians? That will have an effect on Jordan. The last thing Israel needs is for Jordan suddenly to be put in a position where it's no longer stable. So part of what motivated him was, all right, let's look at the region. We don't need a problem here as well. Part of what motivated him is that he had a real relationship with both leaders. People don't know, but he's known Bibi Netanyahu since Bibi was a student at MIT. It's a long-standing relationship, and it's actually a good relationship. And he'd known Abu Mazen for at least the last 20 years. And personal relationships in the Middle East are not a sine qua non for doing a deal, but they're a necessary component. Not sufficient, but a necessary component. So both because he thought, A, we don't need this problem. B, because he had a relationship, he thought, let's make the effort. Now, Stuart asked me this morning, why did he go for the full deal? And I said, part of the explanation is when he talked to two leaders, neither one of them were interested in partial deals. From Bibi's standpoint, any partial deal imposes for him a high price. If he's going to pay a high price, why not get the whole thing? Why not go for the whole thing? It was Kerry's instinct anyway, but both leaders were also saying that. So this helps to explain why he made the effort. Now, again, to remind you of what happened, he took six trips to the region from the time he became Secretary of State until last July. By the sixth trip, he said to both sides, both leaders, he said, you know, I can't just keep coming here if we're not going to get the negotiation resumed. And he basically said to Bibi, I can move Abu Mazen, but I need one of three things to move Abu Mazen to agree to come back to the table for 9 months, and to agree to stay away from going to the international arena for those 9 months. But to get him to do that, I need either you to agree to 67 and mutually agreed swaps as a point of our basis for the talks, to freeze settlements, or to release the pre-hostile prisoners. Bibi made the decision to release the pre-hostile prisoners in four tranches. Now I want to remind you who these prisoners were. These are the pre-hostile prisoners. Abu Mazen used to say to me when I was our negotiator in the 1990s, he used to say to me all the time, why won't the Israelis release these guys? We're the ones who gave them the orders. Before Oslo, we were in armed resistance. That was the character of the struggle. We renounced it as part of the Oslo process. You may recall there was an exchange of letters of recognition on September 9, 1993 on the Palestinian side. They renounced violence. They recognized Israel. And they gave up the issue of resistance. Now Abu Mazen would say to me, we gave the orders to those guys, and they're dealing with us. And the Israelis would say to me, because I used to deal with prisoners along with everything else, but they're the worst of the worst. They're killers. Doesn't matter who gave the orders. Okay, they're killers, and we're not. We also have a constituency, and it's a constituency of the victims. So no Israeli prime minister was prepared to give them up. There were prisoner releases prior to this time, but Rabin didn't do it, Peres didn't do it, Bibi the first time around didn't do it, Barak didn't do it, Sharon didn't do it, Olmert didn't do it, and Bibi did it as part of getting this launched. Now, you know, he chose this as opposed to the two other alternatives, but he chose this. Now, as I said, there were four tranches. It's clear that there was some misunderstanding about what was going to happen with the last tranche, because the last tranche included Israeli Arabs. All the rest were Palestinians, but the last tranche included Israeli Arabs. That last tranche was to be released on March 28th. Kerry, in this process, launched the negotiations. He was dealing with the leaders. He set up a team. There were bilateral negotiations that we would take part in, and those didn't go anywhere. Now, Martin Inge described that this was a mapping exercise of all the issues over several months. It was a mapping exercise, but the truth is each side put out their maximal positions. And I'll tell you the reason. On the Israeli side, they didn't view the Palestinian negotiators as someone who they felt was trustworthy, meaning Saeb Erekat. You can agree with them or disagree with them, but in a negotiation where you're dealing with the most sensitive issues, from the Israeli standpoint, they couldn't be exposed prematurely, and if you're dealing with someone you don't trust and you think will expose your positions publicly, you're just not going to reveal yourself. So this was a mapping exercise, but it was a maximal presentation on each side. You know, you can build bridges over rivers, streams, come from San Francisco, even bays, but you can't build bridges over oceans. And the mapping exercise produced gaps that were of, if not oceans, at least we'll say the size of the Mediterranean Sea. So that didn't go anywhere. But what did go someplace is that Kerry was talking to the two leaders. And he got into discussions on the core issues in a way that were the most serious, in-depth discussions of these issues since the year 2000. When we did it, we went to Camp David, and eventually we came out with the Clinton parameters. When we came out with the Clinton parameters, we didn't pull them out of the air. This came from thousands of hours of discussions with each side understanding what it is they needed. Not what they wanted, but what they needed. Well, Kerry had that exercise. And he also commissioned General John Allen to work with the Israelis on security. And here I'll say this was the most serious security work ever done with Israel on the peace issue and what they needed. So the time that he was investing was meaningful, and he increasingly became convinced that he had a clear picture of both sides' needs, not their wants. He had a clear picture of where the possible bridges were. In his mind, based on his discussions, he felt, in fact, and he hasn't revealed it because he promised both sides that he wouldn't expose their positions, that each side moved. And I know enough about what went on to tell you that, in fact, each side moved in a serious way. Now, it's not up to me to tell you where they moved, because they're not revealing it, and I'm not going to do it. Martin Indyk gave a speech at the Washington Institute, which is my base, last week, and he described, the character of the moves in terms of their content, but he described the moves as being real, and he said about the Prime Minister of Israel that he moved to the point where you were at the zone of agreement. That Bibi moved to a point where you were within the realm of the zone of the agreement. Now, he also said that Abu Mazen shut down. And he shut down at a point where, even though on the one hand Bibi moved to the zone of agreement, Abu Mazen shut down. Now, Martin's explanation in the Q&A there was that because the Israeli settlement activity had created such a context of difficulty for Abu Mazen, that's the reason he shut down. We can get into a discussion of whether that's the reason or not, but clearly there was movement. Kerry felt there was movement, and as we came up on the time for the release of the fourth tranche of prisoners, Kerry realized that we weren't at a point where he could find a way to bridge the differences, maybe because he saw the Abu Mazen shut down, maybe because he felt the context still wasn't right, but he saw enough movement on the core issues, meaning borders, security, refugees in Jerusalem, that he felt it was essential to keep the effort going. And the focus shifted from how do I bridge the gaps right now to how do I keep the process going. Now the Israelis were saying, all right, look, we don't know if the Palestinians are going to keep the process going. And we're supposed to release this fourth tranche of prisoners, and these include Israeli Arabs, and this is a huge political cost for us, and even Tzipi Livni came out publicly and said, why would we release the fourth tranche if we don't know if the negotiations are going to be extended 1 month from now? If we're going to release them, then 1 month from now they left, why would we do it? So Kerry then made a judgment, all right, we got to find a way to keep this going. And he talked to Bibi about, all right, what is it you can do? And Bibi basically said to him, look, I can keep it going, but if you tell me what it's required to keep it going, and it's the fourth tranche, and you tell me, plus additional prisoners, plus some restraint, some meaningful restraint on settlement activity, I need to get some compensation that allows me to explain it. And what I'm going to get from them, which is just a continuation of the process and a continuation of not going to international organizations, is not sufficient. So I need compensation from you. And he raised Pollock. Now, for those of you who've read The Missing Piece, and I know every one of you has, if you go back to Wide River, you'll find that Wide River, Bibi raised Pollard then. Every time he has felt he needed something that would provide him the kind of political oomph, or what oftentimes he'll describe as the political wind of the back to overcome what he sees as the constraints within his coalition, Pollard has come up. Because whether we agree or not, Pollard is defined in Israel right to left. So a powerful letter that Gilad Shalit wrote to President Obama about Pollard. He is seen as a soldier left in the field. And you know what the ethos of Israel? You never leave a soldier in the field. So Bibi raised Pollard. And Kerry, because Kerry was convinced that it was worth keeping this process going because he could see there was a way to get there. Even if he felt that Abu Mazen shut down, he was convinced he could bring him back. And he was convinced that his discussions showed that it was possible to get there, but you needed more time. That's where Pollard emerged. And a package was being worked. The package was still being worked with us and the Israelis when the deadline on the fourth tranche of prisoners was passed. The Palestinians waited for 2 days, and then they came out and announced they were applying to 15 international organizations and conventions. The Israelis then said, okay, look, you just violated the deal. We're not releasing the fourth tranche. Now, that didn't end, by the way, the process, because the two then began to have discussions. And I can tell you, in the discussions, there were some new ideas that the Israelis raised that were meaningful, quite meaningful, and then Abu Mazen came out with the reconciliation agreement with Hamas. Now that put everything on hold. Now the Israeli government at this point, by the way, if you look at what they're doing, they've done certain things, but they're not going crazy. You know, and there's a reason for it. They have no interest in seeing everything collapse. If the PA doesn't exist, is that a good thing for Israel? Who assumes all the responsibility and the cost of the administration of the Palestinians in the West Bank? Israel does. Now, is it so easy for the Palestinians to say, okay, fine, let's just turn over the keys? This was brooded at one point, and then suddenly Palestinians came out and said, no, Palestinians said that. Now, I can tell you for a fact this is what they were saying to the Israelis, and then they stopped. Now, one of the reasons they stopped is because it's profoundly unpopular on the Palestinian side. What's the one clear, unmistakable achievement of the Palestinian national movement? The creation of the Palestinian Authority. There is no constituency that says, let's turn over the keys to the Israelis and collapse the PA. It doesn't mean it can't happen, because If there's one thing we know about the Middle East, what's logical in everybody's interest isn't always done, right? But at this point, both sides are keeping things within bounds. The Israelis are not overreacting so far. They're saying, we're going to wait to see. The deal, the reconciliation deal with Hamas said there's a 5-week period where a new technocratic government should be created. And that new technocratic government will operate for 6 months and then elections will take place. And the Israelis are waiting to see, well, let's see what actually happens. Is this government formed or not? By my count, this is the fourth reconciliation agreement between Hamas and Fatah. There was one in Mecca in 2006. There was one in Doha, I think in 2009. There was one in Cairo. And now there's this one. It's not an accident they haven't, in fact, materialized. Hamas is an Islamist movement. Hamas is the Palestinian Muslim Brotherhood. That's who they are. Now, they're very weak right now because of what's happened in Egypt. So they have an interest. The question is, what is Abu Mazen's interest? Does he have an interest in rescuing them? One of his arguments is, and by the way, you can't completely have it both ways. You can't, on the one hand, say, which some in Israel will say, well, why are we dealing with Abu Mazen? He only represents half the Palestinians. And then the same people will say, oh, we can't deal with him now. Look, he just didn't deal with Hamas. Now, look, either he represents the Palestinians or he doesn't represent the Palestinians. The key here is not that he's done a reconciliation agreement with Hamas. The key here is, what is he requiring of Hamas? If he says, and understand, this deal has two parts to it. One part is the formation of a technocratic government. No Hamas members in it, no Fatah members in it. Just technocrats. Abu Mazen says they will accept, you know, his approach of nonviolence and recognition of Israel and past agreements. And then there's elections. And the other part is that there will be discussions between Fatah and Hamas about Hamas's entry into the PLO. It has been a long time objective of Hamas to get into the PLO. They've not been part of the PLO. Now, if Abu Mazen were to say, yes, they can become part of the PLO, but the ground rules for them becoming part of the PLO is they must recognize Israel, renounce violence, and recognize the previous agreements. If he does that, and they do that, then something has changed. I've often said, people have often asked me, how come I've never been willing to deal with Hamas or to soften the conditions for dealing with Hamas? I said, we have a set of conditions for the PLO. Why would we have a softer set of conditions for Hamas than we have for the PLO? And that should be the ground rules now. If Abu Mazen is insisting that they meet the same conditions to become part of the PLO, okay. So far, I haven't seen that. So far, I've seen it as it relates to the technocratic government. That seems to me not to answer or be responsive. I go through this, though, because if you look at the Israeli behavior is basically saying, we're putting everything on hold. We're not going to have negotiations now until we see what happens over this 5-week period, which will run its course by the end of the month, so we're not that far away. All right, so the question is, having explained to you where we are, what do we do now? And here, my answer is basically the following. You know, the key should be, what's the objective in the negotiations? You know, a question I also get asked frequently is, not whether it was right for Kerry to make an effort, the question was it right to go for the whole deal? Well, I explained to you earlier, that's what he was hearing from both leaders. No partial deal, let's go for the whole thing. But the question is, after these 9 months, and given where we are, and given what we've seen, is it right to go for the whole deal? Are both sides capable of doing it? Now, what Mark Mindick was saying in his Q&A after the speech that he gave, he was describing what the settlement activity did to this negotiating process. And there's no question it had an effect on it. But the settlement activity makes the Palestinians feel powerless. Israel can do whatever it wants, and they feel powerless. Now, there's an answer to that, too, which is, all right, you resolve the border, and then you know where the settlements are. And there's another answer to that, too, which is, if you can see that you're actually making progress on the issues that matter, why not see if you can resolve that, because that will take care of the settlement question. But there's no question that one of the reasons the settlement activity has continued is because of the political dynamics of the coalition. On the other side, if Abu Mazen shut down, did he shut down because it's too hard to do a deal? It's too difficult to present a formal deal to the Palestinians and really have it accepted. And to be honest, I don't know the answer to that. I mean, I've spent at least the last 30 years working on this, and I'll tell you up here now, I don't know the answer to that. So it seems to me when John Kerry now decides what to do, he first has to ask himself the question, what am I trying to get done, and what can I get done, and how do I demonstrate that I don't want this more than the parties do? Because if I want it more than the parties, the one thing I know for sure, it ain't going to happen. So here's my recommendation. Brilliant as it may be. I would favor, first of all, us not walking away. I think it's a mistake for us to walk away. If we walk away, and we basically say the only choices are between you do the whole deal or there's nothing to be done, we then know what the answer is. The answer is nothing will be done, and a vacuum will be created. And in the Middle East, there's one thing we know. Vacuums always get filled, and they're never filled by the right forces. So walking away can't be the answer. But the choices also can't be the whole deal or nothing. So what Kerry should do, I think, is basically the following. He should go and say to the two sides, privately first, and then publicly, because he can test it privately first, and that can affect what he says in public. But he should say, I will not walk away. I will continue to make the effort. But the objective, I have to determine what the objective is. Is the objective conflict resolution, or is the objective conflict management? Now, if the objective is conflict resolution, this is what I need to know from each of you. I need to know that each of you are prepared to do something in public that demonstrates unmistakably that you are prepared to work for a two-state outcome. For Israel, to show that you're prepared to work for a two-state outcome, I want you to do two things in public. I want you to declare, from now on, you're only going to build in what is Israel. You will not build in what you think will be the Palestinian state. That means you'll build in the blocks, and you'll build in the existing Jewish neighborhoods of Jerusalem. Now, the blocks, defined by the Israelis, are everything to the west of the barrier, which is 8% of the territory. Now, the Palestinians won't agree that this is what the right side of the block should be, but the fact is, that's what you negotiate. But Israel will declare, we believe in two states. And because we believe in two states, we will only build in what we think is our state. We will not build in what we think is their state. The size of the block will be negotiated. And secondly, we will allow the Palestinians to actively invest in and engage in economic activity of Area C of the West Bank. Area C of the West Bank is 60% of the West Bank. By the way, it's where all the rock quarries are, and stone masonry is one of the big industries for Palestinians. All the rock quarries are in Area C. The Israelis own them. Palestinians don't. And there's only very limited economic activity permitted to the Palestinians. And it's mostly it's not just a limited basis, it's the exception, it's not the norm. There's no reason Palestinians can't engage in economic activity in Area C. And if they're allowed to do that, it would send a signal. Be completely consistent with the first point, which is we're only going to build in what is our state. We're not going to build what we think is our state. Do those two things in public, and I will know that you're prepared to deal with the political constraints that you face. And to the Palestinians, he should say, I need you to say publicly, as a way of proving that you really believe in two states, not a Palestinian state and a binational state, but in two states, I need you to go ahead and publicly say, you recognize there are two national movements competing for the same space. And because there's two national movements competing for the same space, you believe there has to be an outcome of two states for two peoples. You need to say that in public. I'm not asking you to say Jewish state right now, but I'm asking you to acknowledge there's two national movements. Because that's the justification. That's what gets at the essence of the Israeli concern. That you're really not about two states. And the second thing I need to do, and again, this is consistent with what I just said, the second thing Kerry should say to him, I need you to say publicly that when it comes to the issue of Hamas, the only thing that will make a reconciliation agreement real is for Hamas to accept that to become part of the PLO, it must accept the PLO's conditions on this issue, and it must accept them publicly. Say those two things publicly on your side, and I will know you're prepared to take on the political constraints. Now, if neither can do it, then he says, you told me, okay, I'm not going to try to force you to do what you can't do. But now we focus on conflict management. And conflict management means what? Conflict management means we'll do parallel steps on the ground. No formal agreements required, but parallel steps on the ground. I'll give you an example. First, some of it can be a little bit like what I just described, meaning what each side, as opposed to saying things publicly, you just do certain things practically. But I'll give you a specific example. One thing, if you look at the Oslo process, there were three further redeployments that were required. Now, what that meant was Israel devolved authority to the Palestinians. Now, they did two further redeployments. They didn't do the third further redeployment. So Israel could have said, you know what, we'll do another further redeployment, but we require something from the Palestinians returning. And the U.S. would talk the two sides in parallel about what the Palestinians might do if there was to be a third further redeployment. Or you could have variations on the theme. You know, the Israelis, again, without announcing it, could simply allow Palestinians to begin to do more and more in Area C. And Palestinians would do something in return for that. Like, for example, cut down on the incitement. Begin to do things they wouldn't have to publicly say to do things, just practically begin to do it. Start giving different instructions to the Palestinian media. Start giving different instructions to the Palestinian imams. The point is, you focus on practical steps that don't require formal agreements. Because it may be that formal agreements on the Palestinian side are too hard. Or they have to do things that are irrevocable, that sort. So the point would be a U.S. brokering role, but on conflict management approaches where you focus on parallel steps. Now, if you do it this way, Kerry also has a public explanation for why he's involved, but not the same way he's been involved. And he has a public explanation for why the U.S. isn't going to work for a permanent status agreement right now. One last thought, and then I'll stop. Let's say, which might be possible, let's say that Israel is prepared, that Netanyahu is prepared, to go ahead and do what he asks and Abu Mazen is not. Well, that actually would put Israel in a very different position internationally, wouldn't it? One of the problems today is that the Palestinians have a plan B. And the plan B isn't negotiations, it's internationalizing the conflict, where nothing is expected of Palestinians, and you go to the UN, and you go internationally, and you delegitimize Israel. And nothing is required of the Palestinians. Now, if you can demonstrate that the Palestinians aren't willing to take the steps necessary, but Israel is, you change that equation fundamentally. Now, it might be politically costly for Israel or the coalition internally, but it would address a strategic imperative that Israel requires and faces today. So here again, the approach should be something that's designed to test the possibility of a full deal because of what each side is prepared to do in terms of political constraints. If one side is prepared to do it, the other is not, and today, if you ask me who would be more likely to take the step, I would say probably the Israelis, but I say probably, because I'm not sure. Because even now, if I look at the equation, it's pretty clear to me the Israeli Prime Minister has been prepared to move, but not to do it in a way that's public, because of the political constraints. So I don't know if he, in fact, is prepared to tackle those political constraints or not. I don't mean to minimize them. But again, I don't know the answer to that, and I don't want to assume the answer to that. The one thing I can tell you from all the negotiations is never assume anything. So I'm not assuming anything, but I'm laying out one way we might proceed. Okay, I'll stop there.
The first question we had is a quick one, and then I've got a follow-up here, and that is, Israel had to do one of three things in order for the talks to begin. What did the Palestinians have to do?
What the Palestinians had to do was not to go to international organizations for 9 months, which, by the way, was not cost-free for Abu Mazen, because that's a very popular thing for Palestinians. Palestinians see it as a way to counteract the Israelis. We can sit here and say, all right, look, the Palestinians are doing things only to put pressure on Israel. But again, look at how the Palestinians look at Israeli settlement activity. Israel does very tangible things. No one stops from doing it. What's the Palestinian answer to that? And so they look at the internationalization as their answer to that. The problem is, if it's not just an answer to settlement activity. You know, if there was no settlement activity, would it stop? Is it, in fact, a strategy, or is it only a tactic?
So following up on that, the difficulty that has surfaced about the recognition of Israel's existence as a Jewish state causes much skepticism in many quarters. Do you, based on your negotiations, discussions, and so on, think the Palestinians are really interested in having a state of their own, or are they more interested in the dissolution of the Jewish state?
Look, I think if you ask emotionally where Palestinians are, they'd like a one-state outcome. If you ask practically where they are, I don't think they expect that. But there is a political culture that makes it costly to justify compromise. And I look at the way they've been handling this issue. When I hear, by the way, the story that Netanyahu is the first one to raise it, how come it was never required of the Egyptians or Jordanians? All this forces us to deny our narrative. So let me answer each of those. Why wasn't it required of Egyptians and Jordanians? Because those weren't existential conflicts. Those were state-to-state conflicts. I said earlier, this is about two national movements competing for the same space. So actually, it is important for the Palestinians, whereas it's not the same with regard to the Egyptians and Jordanians, number one. Number two, it was not raised first by Netanyahu. It was not raised first by Tzipi Livni and Olmert. It was raised at Camp David and afterwards. We had discussions, I recall a discussion in September after Camp David, where this was being raised on the Israeli side, and I said to one of the Palestinian negotiators, you don't have a problem with this. The Algiers Declaration, when you finally acknowledge two states 40 years after the 181 partition plan, use the language of the partition plan, Jewish state and Arab state. So you don't have a problem with this. I said, you have a problem with this. I said, what do you mean you have a problem with this? I said, those were your words. The Algiers Declaration said, we have a problem with it. I said, why do you have a problem with it? And he said, because it does two things. One, what about the Israeli Arabs? I said, you can address that. And he said, two, it means we give up the right of return early in the beginning of negotiations. Now, that latter remark is a tactic. Now, it is true that the more the issue has been made public and emphasized in Israel, the more the Palestinians have seen it. It's so important to the Israelis, what do we get for it? That's a tactical question. But that doesn't go to the heart of what you're asking me. What you're asking me is this a tactic or is it something more strategic? And I think, you know, at the end of the day, there cannot be an agreement without the Palestinians accepting this formally. And here's where I get at the issue of the narrative. They're saying, we're being asked to give up our narrative. No, they're not. And I don't need to tell this group, Julie, of all people, I don't need to tell this group, this is not about calling Israel a Jewish state. Because we have a really interesting discussion on what that means within Israel today. Right? It's not about calling Israel a Jewish state. It is about the following way to describe this, which, by the way, doesn't challenge the Palestinian narrative. The Palestinians have to accept that the Jewish people have a right to self-determination in a part of historic Palestine. Just as the Palestinian people have a right to self-determination in a part of historic Palestine. That does not deny the Palestinians their narrative, and it does mean they recognize the right of the Jewish people. And that's what's required here. If they're not prepared to do that, then the answer to your question is they haven't really accepted two states for two peoples. If they are prepared to accept that, then we have our answer. This is a tactic, not something that's fundamental.
So thank you for clarifying that. We have a couple of questions about the settlement activity, which you touched upon. One question, for example, asked why were settlements an obstacle when they were, in fact, in places that are assumed will be a part of Israel anyway and not in future Palestinian land? And then on the other hand, someone writes and asks, should the United States be using more leverage with Israel to come down harder to stop settlement activity?
The first part of the answer is, and this is why I say, if the Israeli public position was we're only going to build in what we think is our state, we're only going to build in the blocks, then you answer that. Because then it's just a question about negotiating the size of the blocks. The fact is, almost all the building right now is within the blocks. Most of it is not outside the blocks, although there is building that's taking place outside the blocks, but it's a small percentage. The fact is, two-thirds of the building last year was within the 1.9% that Abu Mazen says he would accept as blocks. Two-thirds. Almost in the mid-90s, it's within the 8%. A small percentage is outside. But the Israelis don't say that publicly. And they don't say that publicly, again, because of the political dynamics. If they were saying it publicly, it would take away the argument, because you'd be saying, look, what are you talking about? The building's only taking place in what will be part of the Israeli state. All right, maybe there's a small part that's not. But until you clarify that, the Palestinians are able to seize on every announcement. Oh, look, now you know what happens. Because the settler movement wants, here's an interesting point. The left and the right in Israel come together on this, right? The left hates the settlement activity, so they emphasize every announcement. The right wants to create an inevitability about settlement, so they emphasize every announcement. The same projects are announced 4, 5, 6 times. Every time they're announced, it's as if, oh, it's a new announcement. It's a new project. It's not. But that's never clarified. And it needs to be clarified. And as I said, if you're Palestinians and you constantly hear this, you're made to feel powerless. How come the Israelis get to do whatever they want? Not to mention, Israel does control a lot of what Palestinians can do on a daily basis. So it only lends credence to what they already experience on a daily basis. Now the answer is, should we put more pressure on the Israelis on the settlement activity? Let me put it this way. If there's one fundamental mistake that the Obama administration made, it was to declare at the outset it's got to be a freeze on all settlement activity. You know, I wrote a book called Statecraft. The essence of good statecraft is you marry your objectives and needs. What you frame in public as your objective, you never frame an objective in public that you can't achieve. Because you frame it in public as an objective and you can't achieve it, it basically makes you look either impotent or lack credibility. But what did we do? We said settlement activity has to be frozen. At one point it was said, you know, no new settlement building, no outposts, no natural growth exceptions. That was never going to be achieved. Why? Because no Israeli government has ever done it. You know, you're asking a Likud prime minister, head of a right-of-center government, to do what no Labour prime minister did. What we should have said at the outset is there needs to be a limitation on settlement activity. Had we done that, we could define what the objective was. We could define what success was. We created a standard we couldn't possibly meet. Now, we have made this an issue. It has been an issue with every administration. It has been. What more can we do? What we can do is to, if you want to approach it the way I would deal with the second part of the question is what I've said to you now. Why can't Israel say it's only going to build within the blocks? why can't Israel say if it believes in two states, it's going to adopt a settlement policy that reflects its objective of believing in two states? If you ask me, not only is that an effective way to talk about it, it also is likely to have an impact in Israel. That is much more likely to get the Israeli public to say, yeah, we agree with that. What's the best way for pressure to work? It's for it to come from within Israel. When you put pressure on from the outside, in my experience, rarely is it successful. But if what you're doing is seen as being reasonable, it generates pressure from within. And that, after all, reflects the reality of Israel. It is a democracy. I might add, it is the only democracy in the region. You know, I didn't tell you this, but 2 weeks ago, I did something unusual. I debated Noam Chomsky at Brown University. Now, I did it not because I wanted to go debate Noam Chomsky. I did it because Brown University invited me to come and they posed a question. And this will tell you all you need to know about me. It says I'm a sucker for certain things that I can't resist. I mean, if I really think something is just fundamentally wrong, I just can't resist. They invited me and asked the question, does U.S. support for Israel prevent peace? Now, the premise of the question, the essence of the question is, well, the only reason there's no peace is because of Israel. And it would be so wrong that a prestigious university would be posing this for a forum that I said, okay, I don't care who's on the other side, I'm going to go up there. And so I did. And I used it as an occasion to recite the record historically of every time there's been a proposal and who said no or didn't answer. I said, I don't do this theoretically. I've actually been doing this as a practitioner. So I know who said what. I know what was presented. And the point is that there is a historical record here, and I concluded, because I also, the question was U.S. support, and I sort of concluded by saying, there is one country in the region where there is the rule of law, where there is a separation of powers, where there is an independent judiciary, where there are regular elections, where the loser in the elections accepts the outcome, where women's rights are respected, where gay rights are respected, where there is freedom of the press, where there is artistic freedom, where you can see a documentary made by an Israeli like Gatekeepers, or you can see a movie like Bethlehem that shows the cost of occupation on both sides made by an Israeli. Yeah, there's one country in the region that does that, and that's Israel. And that alone is the reason that it deserves U.S. support.
Just a week or two ago, saying that Paris and Abbas had reached some kind of an agreement. Can you comment on that? Is that true? What does that have to say then in regard to, the present leadership, etc.?
They did not reach an agreement. I know exactly what's going on at that time. I was in the administration at that time. They did not reach an agreement. It is true that Paris was working with Abbas, and there was an effort being made at the same time, and the Prime Minister of Israel made a judgment that the other effort, which also included Tony Blair, had more of a chance of succeeding. So at that point, he did suggest that the other effort should go forward, but there wasn't an agreement. I mean, I can tell you for sure there wasn't an agreement.
So what was Paris thinking?
Paris was having discussions with Abu Mazen, and Paris was outlining different things. And look, I can't tell you if Paris had continued that it might not have been productive. I can't tell you that, but I can tell you there wasn't an agreement. What is true is that Abu Mazen views Paris differently. And it does say something about, whether things are possible. I said earlier, why is it that the Israelis in the bilateral negotiations weren't prepared to reveal themselves? Because who they were dealing with. They didn't trust who they were dealing with. You know, it can work the other way too. You have to find negotiations don't work if there isn't an ability to trust the other side so that you reveal yourself. And how do you solve these kinds of problems unless each side is prepared to try out ideas and then not fear exposure if they do it? And that's been part of the problem. So there was, Paris was making an effort. By the way, the Prime Minister knew exactly what Paris was doing. Paris was not doing this on his own. He was keeping him informed. But an agreement wasn't reached, and at the same time, there was something else going on that the Prime Minister thought was more likely to be successful.
Yes, in the beginning of your talk, you spoke about some of the things that are happening in the region. So coming back to that, looking not just on the Palestinian front, but in terms of the impact of the spillover, what's happening in Turkey, as well as you referred to Egypt, the instability in general in the region, is that something that makes this easier or harder? Within that context, also, Putin's moves in Crimea, does that play into this as well? And then finally, how the United States is playing out on some of these things. So in other words, the issues more globally within that region, and also some of the steps the Obama administration declared there would be a red line in Syria, which quickly became evaporated and things like that. So the context.
First, for the last question on the red line, you'll have to read my new book. That book is entitled Doomed to Succeed, the U.S.-Israeli Relationship. I mean, there's a reason I named it Doomed to Succeed. You won't be able to read it this high holidays because it won't be out until next year, but next time. I actually was in Dallas 2 weeks ago, and I started off, you remember, I started off by saying, I usually say that it's someone, I did write a dissertation on Soviet decision-making, and you usually give away the age of somebody, but when you're an expert on a country that no longer exists. But as I said, maybe most people aren't thanking Putin, but yeah, I mean, he's made my expertise kind of relevant again. So. When people say that, oh, Putin went into Crimea, or he's doing this in Ukraine because Obama is not seen as being strong, I'll remind you that he hit Georgia in 2008. And he was doing Transnistria also during the Bush administration. To understand Putin, you have to understand that Putin's not a risk taker. But he defines the former Soviet Union as still being Russia's sphere of influence. And he knows he has dominance locally in terms of leverage and power. He knows he doesn't have to do it directly. He does it through indirection. You see how he does it through indirection. And he will keep doing that. He doesn't see himself running great risks. He sees the Europeans very mindful of the leverage on energy. And so he's going to continue to do this until he decides that the price is too high. Now, do those in the region pay attention to this? Yes. I wrote an article a week before last in the Wall Street Journal. They had a new online forum, so they were kicking it off, and I wrote the first piece in it. And it was about what I call smart power. Soft power is a function of cultural economic advantages where our culture and our model is so attractive that others want to be like us. And it is a source of power, potentially. I underscore the word potentially. Smart power uses soft power and understands that you've got to back it judiciously with coercion. I said the only problem is that Putin and Assad and Khamenei didn't get the memo on soft power and smart power because they still think hard power applies. And in the Middle East, hard power is the measure. And Putin today is seen as being prepared to use hard power. So it has a resonance. And the red line did have an effect. President Obama, when he says, people who, why did I draw the red line? I drew the red line so that the Syrians wouldn't use their chemical weapons, and so we could actually try to stop this. And the fact that I drew it and then made a threat, and we were able to get them to dismantle it, which is true right now, more than 90% of it has been dismantled. And had he carried out the strikes, that would not be the case. That's a fact. But there's an objective reality which he describes, and there's a subjective reality. And if you set a red line and you're not seen as acting on a red line, then the perception of the United States is going to be affected, and it has been affected in the Middle East. Now, the broader region is characterized by enormous upheaval right now. Real hard power matters. Iran is seen as trying to determine and shape the balance of power in the region by what it does in Syria. Iran is all in. The message they send in Syria is, we will do whatever it takes to try to shift the balance of power. The reason that many in the region, put Israel to the side, Israel looks at the nuclear issue as an existential threat in Iran. The Saudis, the Emiratis, look at what Iran is doing on the ground as an existential threat. The pursuit of nuclear weapons from the Saudi-Emirati perspective is an instrument of a broader effort at regional hegemony. They're more concerned by what they see as what's going on the ground in Iraq, in Bahrain, in Syria, in Lebanon, in Egypt. And we have to show we're prepared to compete. And when we show we're prepared to compete by changing the balance of power on the ground in Syria, I made a suggestion, by being prepared to intercept clandestine armed shipments of the Iranians. If the Iranians can be negotiating with us on the nuclear issue and carrying out all these clandestine armed shipments all around the region, we can intercept those clandestine armed shipments. It sends a message to the Iranians, we're prepared to compete. We'll talk and compete. It sends a message to the region. I wrote in one article, I said, imagine if the U.S. had intercepted the Iranian armed shipment that was destined for Gaza with the Israelis. Imagine what the impact would have been. The message to the region would have been, the U.S. isn't going to put up with this. The perception now is we turn a blind eye to a lot of what Iran is doing, which, by the way, we're not doing. But there's a subjective reality and there's an objective reality. And we have to deal not only with the objective reality, we have to deal with the subjective reality.
And one last question, Dan. You talked earlier about the Jonathan Pollard being dangled. Any possibility, or why is it taking so long? And any possibility that anybody in this administration or beyond will go for that?
Well, what is interesting is that the administration seemed prepared as part of this package to go ahead on the Pollard release. I say seen because it was out there in the public. I can't say for sure. Look, one thing I can tell you, every single time Pollard was raised, the intelligence community as a wall came in a unified way dead set against it. George Tenet, when we were at Wide River, threatened to resign over it. And to be honest, if you go back again, read this in peace, you'll see I told Clinton came to me during Wide River and said, asked me, did I think that we needed to release Pollard to do the deal? I said, no. You don't need to release Pollard to do the deal. And I said, I accept what you do. I think Pollard has been in jail long enough. You want to release him, you should release him for that. If you think that he's a benefit to you, you know, don't do it for this because you're going to get this anyway. You're going to deal with permanent status. If you want to use them as a kind of, as an asset in this sense, then use them for something that really matters on the permanent status. But if you ask me, I say it's time to release him. I think he's being treated differently than others who committed comparable crimes. And I pushed with every president for that. Because I still believe it. Now, by the way, I have no tolerance for what Pollard did. Zero. I don't think he's a hero. I don't think he's a hero at all. The guy took money for what he did. People tell me, oh, it's out of belief. He took money for what he did. And I'll tell you, just so you know, I was working in the Pentagon at that time. And to be Jewish, working on Middle East issues at that time was really hard to do. Because there was a built-in presumption of bias. You know, if you came out of the Arab world and came out of the missionary world, you were seen as an expert. If you were Jewish and worked on the Middle East, you were biased. And so this was a deeply embedded attitude, and Pollard goes ahead and he does this. So I'm in the Pentagon at that time, and I can tell you, the last thing I needed was what he did. So I have no tolerance for what he did, and he's no hero. But you don't create a different set of standards. When you treat him one way, you treat others who did the same thing differently. So I've been in favor of his release. And yet, the level of intense opposition from within the intelligence community has been a consistent reality.
As always, without a note, I can tell you there's nothing up here. The analysis and the cogency is simply phenomenal. We've been treated for 45 minutes to an hour of true statesmanship, true scholarship, and a true ability to analyze a situation. And on behalf of the Rabbinical Assembly, we want to thank you for many things. First of all, for your service to this country. We don't ever want to forget that on behalf of this of the state of the United States, of the work that you've, tremendous work that you've done. Secondly, on behalf of the Jewish people, the ability to analyze these things, not merely for rabbis, for all of us, as I sit at JPPI and listen to you over and over again, I'm simply amazed at how you're able to take a complex situation and make it understandable. And thirdly, obviously, for the love of the State of Israel and the Jewish people, which I know is deep down inside of you, motivating you every single day. And so we have for you something that we hope that you'll treasure. It is a beautiful paper cut. In the verses talk about shoftim v'shotrim titein. It's judges and officers shall you make in your places. Deuteronomy 16:18-20. And on the bottom, Hashlosha dvarim ha'olam kayam, aladim v'alamet v'alashalom. The world's established upon three things, justice, truth, and peace. Presented on May 14, 2014 to Ambassador Dennis Ross with appreciation from the Rabbinical Assembly. And I can say on behalf of all of us, Todah rabah, hatzlacha rabah.